This is Global Greek Influence. I'm Panayota Pumenidou. In this episode, my guest and I will talk about the impact history and culture has in diplomacy, what the role of China as a global power is, today's role of the EU and the UN. I'm here today with Themistocles Anidis from Piraeus, Greece. Themis is an author at Hellenic Daily News NI, a news blog for the Hellenic diaspora in the US, Canada, and the world, and is writing articles in magazines and blogs regarding international relations and global politics. Themis aspires an academic career and work with the UN. He is a retired officer of the Hellenic Navy and currently a research intern at the Institute of International Relations. Since his childhood, history was a passion. After the Navy Academy of Petty Officers, he studied cultural studies of Hellenic civilization at the Hellenic Open University. At the same time, he realized his interest in international affairs, leading to an MSc in International and European Affairs at the University of Piraeus. He's about to start next year a second Master's of Arts in Global Policies and UN at Rutgers University in the US. Welcome to the show, Themis.
Good morning, Yota. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, let's start from the last piece of information. So you're going to start soon a second master's degree. So what are you expecting? Why are you delving into the global affairs and the United Nations role?
Well, during my professional experience, I found myself very interested in topics like international relations and global policies strategy and things like this. So I pursued a master's in science at University of Piraeus as the first step. And secondly, I chose to study abroad in the United States in order to obtain a second master's degree in global policies and political science in general. You know, my ultimate dream is to obtain a career in academia. So I think that these are the two necessary steps in order to achieve my dream in the future, in the near future. So I think it's very important for a professional like me to study abroad, not only to study in Greece. Also, I want to get all the feeling of being in a different country, meet a different culture, to meet different ideas, you know, different people. So United States, I think it's an ideal place for me in order to grow my knowledge and my expertise.
As you said, since you were a child, you were really into history. And most of the Greeks, regardless of what profession they choose, they're always drawn to history, to their ancestors' past. What drives one to put history into practice? Because in a sense, diplomacy and global affairs is as putting history in perspective under a realistic spectrum.
Exactly, you're very true. I remember myself reading books of history, Greek history and world's history. If you want to study international relations, I think that you should know history. You should know very well history. Because history and culture, okay, it's a key element in order to know people, a different country, a different state, and know about their decisions, their political decisions. So I put my passion and put it in a realistic perspective, you know, to study international relations. It wasn't at all difficult for me. It was very easy.
Everyday people might think, yes, but how do diplomats put history and culture into perspective in order to have a dialogue at a global level? Because when diplomats have discussions, are with other diplomats, not with everyday people. Yet they are basing their strategy on the history and the culture of a nation.
Diplomats are coming from a country which has history and culture. I think it's very important for a diplomat or an international relations specialist to know the history and the culture of a region or of a country in which he's going to work. If you know the history of a place, more or less, you know, the it's people, I think, and it's culture, you know, the way of their life. So it's of highly importance for an expert to know history, to study history and culture of a country.
You have also studied the culture and history of China. China today is one of the global leaders in many fields, not just economically, but also politically and strategically.
That's very true, yes.
So what is the outlook of China to the world? What can we learn from the Chinese?
Chinese people are very proud of their history and civilization. That's for sure. They are very, very proud. They want to restore China in a place it used to be before the Western invasion. China used to be a superpower. Chinese people invested many things, like gunpowder, like sailing in open seas, compass, many things. What new the Chinese, the China brings in the world. When we are talking about the world, we are talking about the Western civilization, which is very different from the Chinese civilization. So everything is bringing China is very strange to us. Very strange.
In a sense, China has also studied the culture and history of other countries in order to appeal them into financial deals, into some strategic collaborations. But if we go back to what you mentioned earlier, Chinese people are indeed very proud people, and they're very proud of their country. And in a sense, they want to put their country into a strong position, maybe to become the leading nation of this world. There was a transition from their imperial political system into communism, and then they decided to open up to the world. They saw that in this way, under the way this world is running, it is easier for them to fulfill their national strategy based on the current economic environment rather than through promoting communism. And we've seen, for instance, recently what happened in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is not just an important financial center for the world, but it's also an important port. And when we think of China, we think of China as this country with the vast areas of land, but also China is surrounded by sea, and China is investing a lot in its sea expansion. Since you've been a Navy officer as well, you know the importance for a nation when it comes to accessing the sea. Why is it important to China to have also access to not just to the Pacific Ocean, but to as many seas as possible in the world?
Well, China has experienced in the past the century of humiliation. It was invaded by Western powers via the sea. So they are afraid of this, of that will happen again one day. So they want to secure their sea, the Chinese sea. In order to achieve this goal, they are building a navy. They are building fast a navy. Their major opponent in the Chinese Sea is the American Navy. Okay. It's the only force that is equal or even stronger than the Chinese right now. So they want to secure their homeland by dropping out of the Chinese Sea the American Navy. And this is the high strategy of the Chinese. This is something they want to achieve. They want to achieve the regional dominance in Southeast Asia right now. It's the first step towards global dominance. They have experienced this century of humiliation, and the Chinese president said in 2015, I think, no more, no, never again, and something like that. So they don't want to experience something like this again in their history. It was a very traumatic experience for the Chinese people.
What are the selling and Achilles heel points of the Chinese strategic culture?
This is a very interesting question. I think, in my personal opinion, I think it's the same exactly thing. And what I mean, the Chinese people want to make their country once again superpower, as they used to be in the 15th, 16th, 14th century, 13th century, etc. This is something, if they achieve the superpower thing for their country, they will, everyone, every nation in the world will respect them. This is something they want. But Chinese, okay, are very proud of their history and culture. This stream of power, this persuasion of power, may have negative results in other nations in the area. So the selling point for the Chinese is to become a superpower again. Okay, everyone wants his or her state to become a power, a superpower. Every citizen, I said, or the elite of the country. And simultaneously, this dream of power is a nightmare for some other countries in the area.
We see that China explores many ways of accessing seas through its commercial navy, having access to ports, for example, in the Mediterranean Sea. And we are not just talking about having access to Greek ports, but also to ports in Egypt. Would this mean that eventually Chinese have in mind their navy to have access to these ports, not just for commercial reasons?
This is something that we cannot exclude. It's true that the Chinese way, it's to invest in an area like Africa or Latin America, invest in infrastructure. In a different perspective, this means a desire for submission to China's sphere of influence. This is the payback of the Chinese investment. Countries should pay back for the Chinese investment. Of course, when you have somewhere commercial ships, sooner or later you will have your warships there in order to protect trade route for your commercial ships. And I don't see why China does not do this in the future. Will not do this in the future.
Since you mentioned that China has also started to have deals with African countries, with South American countries. What should the African, the South American, and the Middle East countries pay attention to their relations with China?
It's a difficult question, you know, because the Chinese are coming with money, with lots of money, in order to invest. You know, the infrastructure in those regions are very poor, so they need the Chinese events. However, their governments should pay attention to the desire of Beijing to submit them in the Chinese sphere of influence, which this is equal to loss of independence. But I don't think that the regimes in South Africa or care about this. They want the Chinese money, the Chinese investments more.
I totally understand where the African countries, the Middle East countries, the South American countries come from, in the sense that they have been invaded literally or financially from European or North American countries, primarily the US. And now they want to detach themselves from that dependency, but there is the risk of becoming dependent to a new tyrant instead of creating something of their own.
Yes, you're very right. But I want to mention that those countries are very weak, very poor, and the lack of infrastructure is it's huge. So they are dealing with daily basis problems. They want to solve those problems, I think, or their elite are totally corrupted. So it's easy for a Chinese official to, you know, bribe them. Very easy. I don't believe that they think of their independence or, you know, things like that. They want the Chinese money. Those are corrupted. And for those reasons, they want them.
Now, if we go back to our area, which is Europe and the European Union, I remember when Manfred Weber was a candidate for becoming the president instead of von der Leyen. In his proposals, he included also infrastructure investments for African countries in order to become independent of any external factors, meaning that China, that the countries will not be exposed as much as in the past, that they will start having their own infrastructure and they will start building on that. So I'm not quite sure if he was having in mind loans or some programs funded by the EU. He saw that the Chinese were attempting to invest in Africa, and maybe he wanted to counterbalance that. Now we see that the new leadership in the EU has totally abandoned these proposals. Maybe it was just his proposals if he would become the president. Why do European Union countries appear to be in hibernation in order to become a balancing force in current world affairs?
Well, it's about the structure of the European Union itself. European Union is a coalition of states with different levels of economic growth and generally different interests. This is the key point. European countries have different interests. So as a result, it is extremely difficult for 27 different countries with different interests to cooperate and agree to in the EU's high strategy, because we are talking about EU's high strategy right now. Major decisions like this need more time and cooperation spirit. This is something the European Union is lacking. And we can see this in the issues about Turkey. We cannot agree about Turkey's aggressiveness. So I think this is a major setback for the European Union. In a way, European states must find a way to cooperate more directly and more quickly. Because we cannot let the time pass. China is investing. China is considered to be a strategic competitor to the European Union, as well as the United States. We cannot let strategic competitor come to our backyard. Africa, you know, is considered to be the backyard of Europe, and invest and pull the African nations to the sphere of influence of China. This is devastating for European Union's interests.
Many believe that the European Union's interest would lie in having a European Union army. In my opinion, this is far from true. First of all, we have to agree on what the interests of the entire European Union are in terms of global and foreign affairs. And then if we find necessary to have an army, having an army means that we are able, as a European Union, to be involved in a conflict. But before that, first we have to agree on what our common interests are. And as you mentioned, one great example these days is the relationship of the European Union with Turkey, having many European Union countries either remaining neutral, other European countries talking not in favor of Turkey, but talking in favor of taking measures against Turkey. What I've been saying over the past years is that the European Union keeps on funding Turkey despite its regime, despite that Turkey has military interventions to North Syria, Northern Iraq, to Libya. And I was always wondering if actually Turkey was responsible of the refugee crisis, yet it was funded by the European Union for a refugee crisis seemingly Turkey created. One wonders if the European Union checks where Turkey spends its European funding, and why has the European Union not intervened via the UN to stop the refugee crisis?
Well, it's true that the European Union's diplomacy is actually seeing every legal action of Turkey. I'm referring to the invasion of northern Syria, northern Iraq, Libya right now, and the actions of the Turkish Navy in the Aegean and the Eastern Mediterranean Sea against Greece and Cyprus. However, the European Union is an economic giant which is facing internal problems, and I'm referring to the Brexit. It is lacking of unity. This is true. The 27 European countries are not united against an enemy like Turkey right now. Turkey is threatening the European Union openly, and actually nobody answers. I think that the major problem of the European Union is the lacking of grand strategy. The nations, the 27 states, do not agree about the strategy that the European Union will follow. Secondly, we don't have European armed forces in order to be respected, in order to force different countries like Turkey to respect EU decisions.
In my opinion, Turkey would have respected, for example, if the European Union cut its funding. Definitely, Turkey would respect that. We don't have to actually have an army for Turkey to respect the European Union. But as long as the European Union keeps on funding Turkey while Turkey is blackmailing the EU, while Turkey is funding its army to sustain its troops into foreign lands, I'm pretty sure that if the European Union wanted to be decisive, even the economic measures would count at this point in time for Turkey's economy.
I totally agree with you, but the Turkish officials have blackmailed the EU even in this case, even in this scenario. They will let the refugees, the Syrian refugees from Turkey to come to Greece. Okay, maybe this is not EU problems. This is not a problem in Belgium or France. It's a huge problem in Greece, which is a part of European Union. So we don't want something like this to happen.
You know what? It's totally unacceptable for a country to invade North Iraq, to invade Northern Syria, to invade Libya, and the bulk of the refugees come from these areas. And one thing's common, you're creating this havoc in these people's countries. You're creating the refugee wave, yet you are dumping the refugees to Europe, and you are funded from the European Union for the refugees you're getting paid for, but you're dumping them to the European Union, yet you're killing their people and you create more refugees. This is insane.
This is insane and total unethical. However, Turkey has the second larger army in NATO. It's very important for NATO's security in the area. And that's why United States and European Union are letting Turkey behave like this.
I'm sorry, but they're blinded in the sense that they're not serving right now NATO's interests.
No,
they're not securing the region. They're actually creating a havoc in the region. They have destabilized three countries already. And needless to say, their collaboration and their strategic agreements with Russia.
Yes, this was exactly what I want to mention, that Russia is trying to pull Turkey outside NATO. And I think that Turkey is an arrogant state right now. Very arrogant, active illegally, and active surely not as an ally. I don't know until when the United States or European Union are going to accept the Turkish illegal behavior.
It looks like Turkey, under the current president, has established a narrative over the past 10 years, and everybody else seems to react to that narrative. Like the European Union does not have its narrative for the region or for Turkey. Greece does not have its narrative for many, many years. Turkey presents us a narrative, presents us a book. These are the chapters we have at every instance. This is what we say, and we simply react. We are not proactive.
Exactly, exactly. It seems that we don't have an agenda about the future. It seems like I'm talking to Greece especially, it seems like we don't have a strategy on what we want about our country in the next 10, 20, 30, 50 years. And this is a lack of strategy. It's devastating for us. It's very bad for us. It's totally unacceptable, in my opinion, a country like Greece, which is facing enemies everywhere, not have an agenda. I strongly believe that the political powers, the political parties in Greece, should talk about this and create a strategy.
We talked about Europeans' outlook to the region or its non-existing global outlook, I would say. And then many people wonder also what is the impact of the UN today in global affairs, because they've been saying that the UN stands there where it stands in New York, where its headquarters are since its foundation after the Second World War. Yet people are asking themselves, what's the purpose of the UN? How much can the UN intervene in local conflicts and resolve them actually prevent them from happening again, especially since at the UN, one has representatives from all nations around the world?
Well, it's a great question. So I think that the impact of the United Nations in global affairs is still significant. However, we expect, sometimes I think that people expect too much from the United Nations. The purpose of the United Nations was said in a motto of the second Secretary General of the United Nations. It was that the United Nations was not created to take mankind to heaven, but save humanity from hell. This is something that we should never forget. This is the real purpose of United Nations. However, UN represents, reflects the world order of states afterwards the Second World War. And I mean in 1945, where the superpowers were the Soviet Union, United States, and then it was Great Britain, France, and China. However, the world is changing. The world order of states is changing rapidly. We have 2020. So I think that it's for its best interests that the United Nations should adopt their current situation regarding global affairs.
You know what? I'm very keen to see what UN's intervention is going to be in what's happening in Hong Kong or what is happening right now at the borders of Azerbaijan and Armenia, which might not be one of the topics we discuss here today, but yet one would like to see how the UN can help, not so that matters will not be escalated further.
I don't think, to be honest with you, I don't think that UN is able to do anything about regarding Hong Kong because China and Russia, China's ally, have the two seats of the Security Council. So the Western powers, United States or France or Great Britain, simply cannot do anything because of the Chinese or maybe the Russian veto.
How about if the UN, for example, puts like a point system saying that, like in the case we have with our driving licenses, why the United Nations has not put such a point system for countries who, if they're going to be involved in a number of illegal actions throughout the year, their seat will be removed from the Security Council?
Well, it's a little bit complicated. It's more complicated than this because, first of all, all the countries, the 192, 193 countries of the United Nations should agree on the rules. For sure, nobody will agree on the rules. Secondly, I think this will drive the United Nations to collapse, to have the fate of League of Nations because lots of states will leave the organization. Because lots of states are illegal to their own people or to the other states, their neighbor states. So they won't agree to this at all. The world is not only a place of Western powers, democratic powers who respect the individual rights, etc. We have to deal in the Middle East, in South Africa, with authoritarian regimes, actually. So I think it's very difficult.
It's very interesting to discuss these matters because sometimes when we live our everyday lives without really knowing, or sometimes if we sit down and think about a matter as this one for the UN, we might come to the same conclusions, but because we rush through our days having our own problems, we are thinking, okay, the UN doesn't do anything. But then if one sits down and thinks about all the different parameters one has to incorporate and consider, they might realize that the UN does not do such a bad job. But unfortunately, exactly. In many cases, and maybe we can discuss this another time, I've seen that even the UN has fallen the pit of some populistic articles, even though later on they might adopt a different stance.
Okay, UN consists of government. Okay, this is inevitable. So if you have a populist government, a populist government is represented the United Nations. So
I would like to thank you, Themis, for being here with us today. It was very interesting to discuss broad areas of topics without really sticking to the current affairs, like to current headlines. And I hope you enjoyed it too here with us today.
Yeah, I would like to thank you. It was all my pleasure to be a part in Global Greek Influence interview. And I want once more thank you for the invitation. It was an honor for me.
Thank you very much.
Good job.
Thank you very much once again. And I'm pretty sure that in the future we can talk in more detail about matters of current affairs.
And anytime you want.
And maybe in more detail about the Chinese culture and history or the Greek culture and history, and maybe some useful suggestions for what could enrich our agenda or what we can be taught not only from past failures, but also from other nations' approaches.
Exactly. It's very interesting topics. Speaking or talking about the culture of a different country, of the culture of your country. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Themis. And
have a nice
I would
day.
Like you too. And I would like also to thank the audience of the Global Greek Influence, which follows us throughout the summer. But there are many more episodes coming up, so stay tuned.